Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. As we observe Veterans Day, with the military establishment still stunned by the downfall of General Petraeus, we'll begin with two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Tom Ricks, whose new book just out is The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. We'll discuss the gulf between performance and accountability within the highest ranks of the military as the 11th commander in 11 years takes charge of the current war in Afghanistan. Then, following the abrupt departure of General Petraeus, we'll look into the leadership shuffle at the CIA with the former 27-year veteran CIA analyst Ray McGovern. We'll discuss the difficulties the Obama White House have had in establishing an intelligence team, starting with the first director of National Intelligence Council, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, who was ousted on his first day on the job. Then finally, as the Syrian conflict shows signs of spreading with Israeli tanks returning fire against artillery on the Golan Heights, we will examine the newly formed Syrian opposition coalition headed by a prominent Sunni imam. James Galvin, an expert on Syria at UCLA, joins us to describe the makeup of this new coalition that is more likely to receive increased funding and arms as the military stalemate in Syria drags on. And joining us now in the studio is Thomas Ricks, a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for The Wall Street Journal and Washington Post, who has reported on military activities in Somalia, Haiti, Korea, Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Kuwait, Turkey, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He writes a blog at foreignpolicy.com, lectures widely to the military, is a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security, and is a member of the Harvard University Senior Advisory Council on the Project on U.S. Civil-Military Relations. His books include the best-selling Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, its follow-up, The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq 2006 to 2008, and his latest book just out is The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ricks.
Thank you.
And your book, of course, couldn't be on a hotter topic in terms of the focus now on the downfall of not just a regular American general, but somebody that has been idolized, portrayed as both a great warrior and a great intellect. You've known him for some time, and the woman involved as well. What's your personal feeling then about his downfall?
The last chapter in the book, The Generals, is about General Petraeus. I've known him for about 15 years. I've known Paula Broadwell, his alleged lover, for I think 4 or 5 years. My personal feeling is, first, I was shocked. The last general I thought would do this would be Dave Petraeus, partly because he had been so focused, so ambitious, so determined in his life to be not only a general but a great general, a great captain of the military. For him to slip this way is quite surprising to me. That said, you put a guy out, 3 combat tours in Iraq, another combat tour in Afghanistan, a lot of other time out in the field. He's going to slip eventually. I mean, people have more sex in prison than, some guy doing 5 combat tours. It bothers me and it worries me about what it says more about the nation than what it says about General Petraeus. First, that somebody who has given so generously of his time and his family has given receives, when the time comes, so little generosity from us, so little forgiveness from us. Second, and this angers me, why the hell do we care more about somebody's personal sex life than his public competence? We have a lot of mediocre generals who keep their pants on. I'd much rather have a really good general who might occasionally like a roll in the hay. And the funny thing is, historically, that's been true. We have not always been so hypocritically puritanical in our judgment of our military leaders. In World War II, Dwight Eisenhower pretty openly carried on with his beautiful red-haired British driver, Kay Summersby. Yet he wasn't fired on the eve of D-Day, told, sure, some soldiers are going to get killed, but you got to go home because you didn't keep your pants on. Likewise, in the Korean War, Matthew Ridgway, another great general, turned the war around early in 1951. Also had a reputation of a womanizer. In fact, seemed to get a new wife for each war. When I was researching the generals, I would be in the military archives looking through his personal papers among other generals. And a lot of these papers are about how do you get better commanders in Iraq? How do we do – I mean, I'm sorry. How do you get better commanders in Korea where he's leading during the war? How do we fix this war? Interspersed with all those military documents, there are occasionally terse notes from his first wife's divorce lawyer. We seem less tolerant of that these days. We seem so permissive when it comes to public execution of one's duties. You want to be a mediocre general? Not a problem. But we are so exacting about private behavior. It's almost like becoming a general these days is like a university professor with tenure. Nobody cares if you're lousy at your job, but if you embarrass the institution, then you got to go. So bottom line is the news flash this week, we found out David Petraeus is human.
Well, you know, the gold standard in your book, The Generals, of course, is General Marshall. And he counseled Eisenhower when he was thinking of leaving Mamie for K. Summersby. Mm-hmm. And General Marshall basically said, you know, straighten up and
straighten
fly
up
right.
And fly right. And he said it also because he said, Ike, you don't understand how important you're going to be in post-war Europe. You can't just go and retire now. We are going to have to hold together this shattered continent. And you're going to be the American face of that. And if you overthrow your wife and marry the driver you've been boffing, that's not going to work. And so he basically gave him a good talking to and sent him back out in the field. And Eisenhower, who could be a very cold man, followed his orders and cut off Kay Summersby without another word.
So Tom Ricks, again, the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for The Wall Street Journal and The Washington Post. His latest book is The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. Now, in terms of this gulf between performance and accountability, which is very much what your book reveals, I was always struck by the similarities in a way between Westmoreland of Vietnam and Tommy Franks of Iraq, in as much as they both came out of artillery. And mm-hmm. and so what does that say?
It's actually a good observation and not one I expect on Pacifica Radio.
Well, yeah, I'm the token right winger here.
It's funny. That's what my parents used to say when I covered the military for the Wall Street Journal. He covers fascists for a fascist newspaper. It's an astute observation. When Westmoreland was sent to Vietnam, there were concerns and objections inside the Army at the time. This is an infantryman's war. You need an infantryman, someone who knows about being out on the patrol, rather than somebody whose specialty is the deliverer of firepower at a distance. And I think that did skew the way we fought that war. Tommy Franks, similarly, big believer in firepower and probably the low point of modern American generalship. I want to point out, though, something that really struck me in writing the book. Tommy Franks was not an aberration, was not an anomaly. He was exactly what the U.S. Army was trying to produce. Very tactically oriented, a guy focused on combat, focused on the first battle, the first day of a war, and really quite good at the first day of battle. Clueless about what to do to end the war.
He succeeded in losing two wars, right?
Yeah, most generals.
He let bin Laden go. And how much do you hold him accountable for that? I mean, I thought that was Rumsfeld's call.
No, I think quite a lot, Tommy Franks. Part of the job of generals is to push back on civilians when necessary. I think Tommy Franks was intimidated by Donald Rumsfeld, who could be quite a bully. But hey, Tommy Franks was a four-star general. There's a reason you have those four stars. That's the level at which you talk back politely, respectfully, and candidly to civilians, which was the great skill of George Marshall with Franklin Roosevelt. The reason Marshall was picked by Roosevelt to lead the army is because he spoke truth to power. When he needed to say what he thought to Roosevelt, he did. He didn't just salute. So Tommy Franks is a unique figure that I can, as far as I can tell in our history, most generals get a chance to screw up one war. Tommy Franks screwed up two. In Afghanistan, yeah, he pushes bin Laden and al-Qaeda into Pakistan. Now, let's see. We're going from Afghanistan, a small, unstable Muslim country, to Pakistan, a big, unstable Muslim country with nuclear weapons. Is this a good idea, General Franks? I don't think so. He does it twice. First at Tora Bora in late 01, and then again in Operation Anaconda in the spring of 02. But we're not finished. Then he goes to Iraq and does the same thing he did in Afghanistan. I take the enemy capital, and then I say, I've won, and I leave. In both cases, in Kabul and in Baghdad, that was not when the war ended. It's when it began.
Right. Quick victory followed by a slow defeat.
Yeah. And a belief that somehow it wasn't his problem, which is actually the key job of a general, to connect the military action to the political outcome. This is basic Clausewitz, but he thought it wasn't his job. So effectively, Tommy Franks was a jumped-up battalion commander who knew how to lead a battalion but not how to lead a war.
So again, Tom Ricks, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for The Wall Street Journal and Washington Post, his latest book, The General's American Military Command from World War II to Today. The 11th general now, in the 11th year of the Afghan war. And of course, Petraeus was the architect of counterinsurgency, and there were others who were pushing counterterrorism, I think led largely by Joe Biden. What's your analysis of that? That seems to be essentially all a waste of time, money, manpower. I mean, what do we have to show for that extra so-called surge in the 11th? This is the longest war, after all.
Yeah. The surge in Iraq had a purpose that it achieved, which is to get us out of Iraq. In Afghanistan, we have not succeeded, and I'm hearing pretty worrisome things about Afghanistan. That said, in the long run, and I lived in Afghanistan as a kid, I know the country. I am more optimistic about Afghanistan than I am about Iraq, partly because I think Afghans still have a sense of a country that I don't see when I talk to Iraqis. Iraqis are really split and stalemated along ethnic and sectarian lines.
So in other words, we broke that country. That's what Colin Powell warned, didn't he? If you break it, you own it.
Well, but we don't own it.
Exactly. That's the point.
We broke it and the Iranians collected. We knocked down the wall that really was the bulwark against Iranian expansion westward. I think we may have a new axis of evil emerging. Syria, Iraq, Iran, and Pakistan. So a country that we thought we conquered, a country we thought was an ally, lining up with the country that we keep on saying is so terrible, Iran, and we're getting Syria in the bargain. This is not a net gain in the Middle East for us. Yes, at the expense of thousands of American lives, tens of thousands of Iraqi lives, and billions upon billions of dollars. But I want to go back to one thing you mentioned, 11 commanders in 11 years in Afghanistan. This really bothers me. A friend of mine, Andrew Exum, who fought in Afghanistan as an army officer, wrote recently about the casual arrogance with which we have fought our wars. And I think that's a really telling phrase. And 11 commanders in 11 years really brings that home. The thought that we can go and just rotate our commanders mindlessly, 11 commanders in 11 years. If you had 11 CEOs of a corporation in 11 years, it would collapse. Yet we somehow think we can put guys in and they can figure it out and run the war and leave. It reminds me of something Warren Buffett once said. I'm not sure we're allowed to quote Warren Buffett on Pacifica, but I will anyways. Warren Buffett once said, if you've been playing poker for half an hour and you don't know who the patsy at the table is, you're the patsy. When we put a new commander out in Afghanistan every year, we are making him the patsy. Everybody else knows where all the bodies are buried, what's in the closet, what's the secret agenda of somebody. He's still figuring it out. And when he's just about figured it out, he leaves. I actually had a friend who was a Marine officer, a Marine intelligence officer in Afghanistan. At the end of 1 year, he said to his command chain of command, you know, I'm beginning just to figure this thing out. I'd like to stay for another year. And the response was no, it's someone else's turn.
So this is what they used to call ticket punching. Is that still going on?
Yeah, it's also this mindless way that sort of the bureaucratic military runs. Oh, we're just going to rotate everybody in like they're interchangeable pieces. And we're not really going to judge anybody on their performance. So you don't see officers who are successful promoted quickly. You don't see mediocre officers chastened and told to do better. And you don't see lousy officers having consequences for their career. The military just marches on and on. Now, Defense Secretary Robert Gates tried to address that. He actually called General Petraeus back from Iraq during wartime, it was unprecedented, to run a promotion board for new Army Brigadier Generals. And Petraeus really picked a different set of generals. Intelligent people who could think critically and had demonstrated effective combat leadership.
So the army is not, or the military is not the meritocracy that as advertised.
I don't think it is. And I don't want to hit on the military too much here. The army is a great, diverse institution that does better with race and drug issues than any other major American institution I can think of. The frontline soldier is well-trained, well-equipped, and operates in a cohesive unit. And these are all good things to have. Yet we do not give our troops the leadership they deserve. We have confused, I think, in our reaction to Vietnam, supporting the troops with supporting generals. One way to support the troops is to question the generals, to push them. But I think as a nation, we're no longer equipped to do that.
Oh, our congressmen all the time say, slavishly defer to generals.
And they say, I support the troops and so on. Yeah. Congressman, you want to support the troops, learn about the military, learn to ask questions. Mm-hmm. As late as the Vietnam War, two-thirds of the Congress had military experience. Today, two-thirds do not, and it's going down. The same is true in the media, lack of military experience. The same is true in American public life generally. And I think we no longer know how to judge military competence. Now, we all think we're experts on sex and morality, so we feel perfectly free to judge people on that. That may be one reason that we give people a pass on professional competence, but judge them severely on their personal lives. And I think it's frankly disgusting.
Again, Tom Ricks, the author of the new book, The General's American Military Command from World War II to Today. Just in the last couple of minutes, then you mentioned, we talked about General Marshall during World War II and how he would speak truth to power and to FDR, his commander-in-chief. That's sorely lacking. Obviously, there's we have civilian control over the military, which is clearly a good thing. But when you look at George W. Bush, talk about casual arrogance. I mean, and the neocons that beguiled him into that war. I mean, I know Brent Scowcroft tried to talk sense to them, but they froze him out. You feel like you wish that some of those guys, and there was somebody else there, not Tommy Franks. Actually, there was Shinseki. At least he tried to tell the truth, didn't he?
General Shinseki did. He was Army Chief of Staff, and he said, we don't have enough troops in the invasion force. That's exactly the type of moment at which FDR and Marshall would have said, okay, time out here. Let's examine that. And that goes to the root of good civil military discourse. What you want is discussions between the civilian leaders and the top military that say, what are our assumptions and what are our differences? Let's examine and explore them. For example, assumption of Vietnam, that Hanoi would have a breaking point before the Americans did. Never examined. Turned out it was wrong. Assumption of the 1991 Gulf War. If we give Saddam Hussein a good thumping, he will fall from power. Again, an assumption that was unexamined and turned out to be wrong. Marshall and FDR and the people around them really sat down and examined their assumptions, and they explored their differences, painful though it might be. Good civil military relations doesn't mean everybody gets along chummy. Sure. Sometimes it means you get real anger and blood on the table, but you don't want to shy away from it. You want to take this very seriously. Another thing I liked about Marshall and his dealings with Roosevelt, he was not at all social with him. Once Roosevelt addressed Marshall as George, and Marshall made it clear that he preferred to be called General Marshall. He didn't like to dine with FDR. He didn't laugh at his jokes. The first time he ever visited the president's home at Hyde Park was for Roosevelt's funeral.
And of course, the fundamental difference here is that the World War II, the Japanese attacked at Pearl Harbor. The Iraq War was a war of choice. So the real advice would have been, which is what Scowcroft tried to do, was to say, don't do it in the first place.
And the role of the military at that point, it would have been to say, sir, we will execute your orders. But before you do, have you considered this? Why are you doing this? As far as I know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, Richard Meyer, never said to Rumsfeld or the president, what do you think you're doing here? Why do you think you're doing? What are the consequences going to be? And I'm sorry, that's hard to do when you're talking to your boss. That's the job. Okay. And he didn't do it. In fact, I would say that's a moral collapse of the role of the top military officer.
Well, Tom Ricks, we could talk on here for a while, but we've run out of time. And I thank you for joining us here today.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Again, I've been speaking with Tom Ricks, who is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for The Wall Street Journal and The Washington Post, who has reported on military activities in Somalia, Haiti, Korea, Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Kuwait, Turkey, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He writes a blog at foreignpolicy.com, lectures widely to the military, and is a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security, and is a member of the Harvard University Senior Advisory Council on the Project on U.S. Military U.S. Civil-Military Relations. His books include the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, its follow-up, The Gamble, General David Petraeus, and The American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006 to 2008. And his latest book just out is The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the leadership shuffle at the top of the CIA.